Welcome to the Brown Theater for what promises to be a wonderful concert tonight. It's a pleasure to be with you again. And I'm glad to see some familiar faces in the group, which means I haven't scared anyone off with the way I do these lectures. This is my third one this season. So now that it's the third main classics concert of the season, I don't mind sharing with you that I post messages about these lectures on my Facebook profile. I don't say anything about the audiences, of course. I just tell my friends what the lecture's about and what the orchestra will be playing. And it's kind of funny because the concert lineup seems to determine which of my friends chooses to like my post, comment on it, or, in some cases, just ignore it. So for those of you who don't know much about Facebook, the way it is, you post it, and your only choice is either to like it. There's no unlike option or dislike. You can say something about it, or you can just leave it be. So today, for example, my French music scholar friends gave me the big like, probably because of the Bizet Symphony. Now my hip contemporary music friends gave me the like, probably because of the Philip Glass work. And I'm not sure if I have any specifically Benjamin Britten scholar friends, but I can tell you whose names were noticeably absent from the list, and those were all of my friends who prefer music from the standard German canon, because there's no Beethoven, no Brahms, no Mahler, something completely different. So they just ignored me altogether. Now, in both of my previous lectures, I've commented favorably on the relative progressiveness of the orchestra's programming this season, and tonight is another stunning example of what thinking outside the box can get you.
We can get us a lot of people who said, Philip Glass, no wonder I'm not coming.
Well, and I hope to change their minds, assuming that they did come. So we have two wonderful symphonies by composers not really identified with symphonic writing, the contemporary minimalist Philip Glass and the 19th century French opera composer Georges Bizet, who, of course, was most famous for his opera Carmen.
But Benjamin Britten was also an opera composer.
Oh, that's true, yeah. So Benjamin Britten also very famous as an opera composer, but we are featuring some of his vocal music tonight, so it is more in his standard idiom. Now, you might think it's a bit unusual to have two symphonies on the same program, but I can assure you that this program is not quite as heavy as this pairing might suggest. The Glass piece is written only for strings, and it's just under 25 minutes, so that makes it a bit longer than a typical overture, but it seems to function in that way as far as the overall programming is concerned. And then the Bizet is similarly short. I think it might be a little bit longer than the Glass.
It's 30 minutes, except that if you make all the repeats, there's some that I left out. And so it's going to be about 28 minutes.
Yeah, and it's so it's short, and it's also quite light in a Mozartian sort of a way. Now, perhaps most unusual, though, is the middle piece, where we would typically find a solo concerto, and it's actually what I would call the heaviest work on the program. Now, concertos are designed to showcase the virtuosity of a soloist, and this piece certainly does that. But this one also challenges our intellects and maybe even tugs at our heartstrings in a way that a concerto doesn't always do, because Britten's Serenade is certainly a weighty work of art with its somber texts and at times difficult musical language. Now, sometimes I feel like my role here is to get in the mind of the artistic director a little bit, and so I tried to come up with a theme for tonight's show, and all I kept coming up with was the key of C major, since both symphonies are heavily weighted towards C. But in the end, I decided that a 20-minute lecture all in the key of C major might be a little boring and repetitive for you, although it would certainly fit very well with a symphony by Philip Glass, a symphony by Philip Glass, a symphony by Philip Glass, a symphony by Philip Glass. Now, what I came up with instead is that each of these pieces has an unusual relationship to music history more generally, and two of them are directly related to the advent of recording technology. And so I'm going to ask George a little bit about how recordings fit into this. Now, let me explain just a little bit first. Most classical music listeners of a certain generation, now before you get all defensive, I'm including myself in that generation, acquired their knowledge of classical repertoire primarily through recordings, not necessarily going to live performances. And this is either through dozens or hundreds of times listening to the same recording, as I did many times when I was a kid, listening to the same CD or even LP record over and over and over again, or maybe through a few listens to dozens of recordings of the same piece. So I know people who have every recording imaginable of all the Beethoven symphonies, and that's how they get to know the repertoire. Now, most listeners seem to prefer one conductor's recordings over another, attributing these preferences to the specifically musical choices that the conductor made, or what we might call the conductor's interpretation of the score as set down on the record in that moment in time. So I really prefer Toscanini's Beethoven symphonies, for example, versus someone else. Now, in the case of Benjamin Britten, I have to imagine that it's difficult for a conductor today to approach some of his pieces, especially the vocal works, because the singer for whom Britten wrote most of his music, his lifelong companion and lover, the tenor Peter Pears, had a very distinctive voice and became closely identified sonically or orally with Britten's music through his extensive recordings of the pieces, including of this serenade. So what I'm saying is, if you know this piece through recordings, you likely know it through the recording of Peter Pears singing it, and that's how it's come down to us. And Britten himself usually served as the conductor. Now, just before I tap George for his input on this question, I want to illustrate just how closely associated Pears and Britten were in terms of a particular sound. The old saying goes that you don't really understand a foreign language until you can laugh at jokes in that language. Well, the British comedian Dudley Moore, a name that I'm sure most of you recognize, he understood the Pears Britten sound so well that he was able to sing a version of the nursery rhyme, Little Miss Muffet, in the style of Britten and Pears. And here we go. Here's the Britten Pears sound.
And now, Dudley Moore continues to accompany himself on the pianoforte, first in a setting of an English song. A setting by Benjamin Britten of the old English air, Little Miss Muffet. The Miss Muffet referred to in this song is believed to have been related to the English entomologist of the same name.
Here we go. Wasn't really like Pears, but this really over-the-top emotional expression, Miss Moffat, away. That sound is the typical Britten Pears sound, and the way he was playing the kind of lush triadic harmony really captures this sound. And it's almost like you're listening to the serenade to the words of Little Miss Muffet. So my question for you, George, is this. When you tackle a work like the Britten, or really any piece of music for which there are iconic recordings, what role do recordings play in your study, and how do you work within that tradition, if at all, or do you just look at the score? How does that work?
Well, if there's a recording by the composer, that helps a little bit, although, you know, composers are usually the worst, their own worst interpreters. For example, Stravinsky made several recordings of The Rite of Spring, and each one is totally different, one from the other. I wonder what Mozart would have sounded like playing one of his concertos. So I listen to it just to get an idea. But very often, I listen to classical music as interpreted by Richard Strauss, because he made a lot of recordings. And it is amazing how very often his insight into the music that everybody seems to know is revelatory. Revelatory? I don't know where the accent goes. If you're Hungarian, it's revelatory.
It's revelatory for us, too.
Oh,
yeah.
Goody.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. I actually performed another piece of Benjamin Britten, Les Illuminations, on poems by Rimbaud with Peter Pears. That was a wonderful experience. He was very easy to work with. And I've also done the Beethoven Triple Concerto with Dudley Moore playing the piano.
Oh.
And he was also a very, very nice guy. So those are my memories of these two things. Now, are you going to do anything about the poems?
I wasn't. So you can go ahead and take it away. I was going to say one thing about the...
The poems are incredibly beautiful.
Absolutely.
If you look at the very first one that is listed, which is the pastoral, it actually talks about the sun setting and how it makes the shadows be longer and bigger so that an ant looks like an elephant. And it's really an incredible picture to see. And a little stripling looks like a giant oak tree. So this is a gorgeous, beautiful picture. But I have... Does anybody know who Polypheme is? No? No Mars bars to anybody? Do you remember Dr. IQ?
Yeah, yeah.
Up on the right! Give that man a Mars bar! I learned Dr. IQ in Spanish because they had Dr. IQ in Mexico. So, how do you pronounce the poet O-V-I-D? Ovid? Okay. And that was his name for a tree. So when you see the thing, whilst the small stripling following them appears a mighty Polypheme, it's a mighty tree. And then, who knows what Phoebus is? Phoebus is the sun. And so the next to last line, till Phoebus dipping in the west shall lead the world the way to rest. So that's the sun. So it's I love this poem. Then the next one, were you going to talk about Blow, Bugle, Blow?
No, but I do have a small excerpt from that if you want to hear that.
Yeah, it's really
section.
Fantastic,
yeah.
Because it's the echoes of the words, blow, bugle, blow, and then the horn. John Gustley, is he going to be here, by the way? He said he might, our soloist, to show a little bit about the horn, because the very opening and the very closing of this piece is a kind of meditation on the what was supposed to be the natural horn. A natural horn has no valves. And so valves have the function of changing the size of the tubes so that you can play in tune. Because if you're playing on a natural horn that has no valves, the harmonic sequence when it starts with the lowest possible note on that, and then up goes an octave, and then a fifth, and then it starts getting out of tune. And so what you're going to hear is a little out of tune playing, but it's on purpose, and it has a kind of medieval quality to it and a very haunting quality. So...
I actually don't have the opening handy, but I was going to say that this natural horn feature occurs at the beginning and the end of the piece, and the two sections are exact repetitions of one another, and this medieval quality about it, it almost draws you into the story because it serves as a framing device. And so we hear this solo horn that almost is like Britain saying, let me bring you into my world. And then we get the first vocal movement, which is the first poem. And then we hear the six poems, and then finally we end with the narrator coming back in as the horn and kind of waking us back up from dream world. And, you know, here we are back alive in Louisville. Right. And that's how these horn movements function.
Yeah.
But the bugle movement you were talking about, did you want to say something about the words, or do we want to kick in the...
Sure, let's hear it.
So this is from the second vocal movement, or the third actual section of the piece, and they're talking about blow, bugle, blow. And you can hear how the horn seems to be that character. So there's a little bit of literal word painting happening here.
Does anybody know P.D.Q. Bach?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember P.D.Q. Bach? He's got Iphigenia in Brooklyn, which is one of the pieces that P.D.Q. Bach wrote, has the same words, dying, dying, dying. And so every time I hear this, I almost laugh, unfortunately. Because I used to be his conductor. I did actually two P.D.Q. Bach concerts here in the past, in which one of them I appeared with no pants, which creates quite a commotion.
Well, later in the season, there's a P.D.Q. Bach piece, right? Well, are you going to show a pantsless for that,
it's
too?
It's a Peter Schickley piece.
Oh, Peter Schickley, okay.
Yes.
All right. His alter ego.
His alter ego. Yes. So now there's another little test. Let's see. I have these things stick together. One second. Okay, so look at number six, the hymn. Now, one of the amazing things about the hymn, when you see Queen and Huntress, chaste and fair, now the sun is late to sleep, seated in thy silver chair. And it sounds like a regular poem that you declaim at its usual slow, very measured speed. And he wrote this as a scherzo with a very, very fast 6/8 chasing. The horn is chasing the singer, who's chasing the orchestra, and it's very fast. And so you can't tell by. So this is what's amazing about composers. They're able to take a text and imagine a setting that is completely against what you think it should be. And here's a test for you. Hesperus entreats thy light. Who is Hesperus? The evening star. See, if you'd asked me this a week ago, I couldn't have answered. And then there's another one. Cynthia's shining orb. Cynthia is the moon. Okay, so now you know everything you need to know about this piece.
all the mythology behind it, yes. So thinking about, I will say more about the Britten, too, but I want to switch our focus a little bit to the Glass Symphony as well. I have a colleague named Jeremy Grimshaw at BYU in Utah, and he has an article about Philip Glass as a symphonic composer. As I mentioned, this wasn't his initial compositional thrust to write symphonies. It was to write operas and multimedia works and other things specifically involved with popular culture. But he points out that critics had radically different responses to performances of the piece, this particular third symphony, by the same ensemble. One of them was recorded and one was live. Now, a reviewer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune gushed that the Stuttgart Chamber Orchestra under Dennis Russell Davies captured the brilliance of Glass's string writing by maintaining immaculate rhythmic precision, which seems appropriate for this piece. Now, later that year, a New York Times reviewer, I don't know how much we can trust him, heard the same ensemble under the same director give a performance of the same piece and complained that Davies and the group did a terrible job at maintaining the clarity of the rhythm and the lines. Now, what Holland didn't mention, of course, that's the New York Times reviewer, is that in a recording studio, you can work with a click track in the ears of the musicians and replay a section so many times that you need to make it perfect. And then you're left with just that, basically a perfect finished product that then gets circulated as a definitive interpretation of a piece. But if that's how people get to know it, it's unfair to judge a live performance when you don't have the benefit of the technical apparatus.
The click track is a computerized thing that clicks in your ear, and it's can be programmed. For example, if you have, like in this second movement of this piece, lots of irregular bars that have 5/8 notes and 7/8 notes and 6/8 notes that go, you can actually have the click track give you that. It can be programmed exactly so that if you're with a click track, you're going to be perfect. Yeah, it is unfortunate that recordings nowadays set a very high standard, but what's fortunate about it is that we have to come across as technically perfect as what you hear on a record. So that's raised, in many ways, the level of playing, particularly in this country. And so That's the question. Now, Dennis Russell Davies was a student of mine, and I cannot believe that he has bad rhythm, because I would have flunked him.
Yeah,
otherwise.
I think it was kind of an unfair criticism,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and is there a particular time that you have to go? It's
Just before the downbeat. No, I have to leave. I have to leave at 7:30 just to refresh my brain. Who's against applause between movements? One person, two persons, three persons. So what do you do when you go to opera and somebody does a fantastic aria?
Do you wag your finger at the people who do clap? Or okay.
You know, I have my theory. Right, so but it doesn't interfere with the whole arc of the music in opera or in a jazz club. So I think it was Wagner and his ilk that created the illusion that between the artist and God there should be no separation. And that what the artist has to say is so perfect and so sacred that human beings who would like to enjoy it should keep it to themselves. So, you know, I really feel sorry for people who actually feel enthused of it. But, you know, if I ask an audience, applaud whenever you feel like it, then they're going to applaud all the time, which is the wrong way, too. So it should be like kissing somebody. You want to do it or you don't do it. You know, so anyway, that's my opinion about
that. Well, and there was a time before Wagner when symphonies often weren't even performed in full all the time. You know, one movement of a symphony would be performed alongside excerpts of many other things.
Yeah, they have Miss So-and-so singing an aria from some other composer. And actually, audiences who liked, for example, I think the Beethoven 7th, the second movement, was applauded so much they had to repeat it. And every composer I know loves the fact that audiences love it so much that they applaud. So that's my take on that. And so, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt that.
Oh, no, sure. Well, I didn't write too much about the Bizet because I wanted to say a bit more about the glass myself, but I'm wondering what your thoughts were on the Bizet piece in general.
Well, it's one of the most beautiful pieces ever written. It is so full of joy. He wrote it when he was 17 as a graduation piece for the Conservatoire. He was copying his teacher, Gounod, who wrote a piece, a symphony, also, I believe, in C major, I believe. And when you hear the Gounod after you've heard the Bizet, you know that the teacher didn't know as much as the student. This piece is drop-dead gorgeous. The second movement is beyond belief. And it was unplayed until 1935, 77 years ago. Was it Weingartner who discovered it sitting in some musty old library?
Granny's attic, as we like to call it.
Yeah. and he's the first performer of this piece. And I can't believe that it lay. You know, also the Carnival of the Animals of Saint-Saëns wasn't played until much later. So there's still little gems here and there that are worth digging up.
Yeah, and one of the mysteries about the Bizet piece is that we don't really know why he decided not to have it performed during his lifetime.
He was probably ashamed that he was trying to copy his teacher, is what I think.
That's possible, yeah, that he felt that it might have detracted from his own emergence as a great composer, although the work, it's really wonderful. I mean, it sounds very Mendelssohnian at times in the scherzando-type passages. And
well, he didn't know he was going to be great until he became great.
True. Yeah, but I personally hear a lot of his work, his operatic mind at work in the symphony and the lyricism
right.
of it and the accompaniment.
Now, here's the best-looking horn player in the world, John Gustily, and he's going to show us something about the horn that you didn't know. Howdy.
I'm the best-looking conductor.
That was the oldest. Yeah, me too. Okay. So anyway, I hope you're all excited about hearing this Britten, and it really is sort of a fundamental work for the horn. Written in 43 by Britten. He's really the first time that the horn, all its sonic possibilities are used. Britten really incorporates all these different sounds and techniques into the piece, and the piece starts with a natural horn call based on the natural harmonics of the instrument, like the old Waldhorn. So the very first pieces that were written for horn. And the notes are actually, the scale is, some of the notes are in tune, some of the notes are naturally out of tune.
Was I lying?
So we're actually supposed to do it this time on purpose.
For once, right?
Right. So their very opening open fifth. So far, so good. Now, slightly out of tune notes kind of gives it kind of a rustic and maybe a ancient, almost primeval sounding effect. So that's the natural horn. Now the song cycle begins, and the first song uses the horn in a traditional sense, for the most part. The setting of the second song is a Tennyson poem about the splendor falls on castle walls. Blow, bugle, blow, and you hear the echoes. So the horn now is used in sort of a trumpety bugle type of way. Now, then he talks about an echo, so he uses the mute, a thin and clear sound. Another technique he uses in the elegy, the Blake poem, which is about death and decay, very twisted and tragic song, I think, to represent sort of this invisible worm that represents death or destruction.
And the orchestra actually also has a worm kind of sound with their basses and cellos go. That's his tone painting, but that's...
Tone, right, and using sevenths and major sevenths, half steps. And another thing, Brain... So the piece was originally written for Dennis Brain, who really kind of set the standard with this. There's a Decca recording, I think, from 53 or 54, with Goossens conducting Peter Pears, which is really sort of a landmark recording, especially for horn playing. And one of the things that Britten did using the horn was also the horn has quite a large range, so a 3.5 to 4 octave range. And Britten so uses the entire range that on the horn, so the very lowest note that we usually play,
but you can't play it unless you look very serious.
And then that top note also, you also have to look very serious on the top. there's that half step again about the elegy, the Blake poem. So,
tell us about that 6/8 thing, because it's so against the mood of the poem when you...
Oh, right. You mean, so it's a little ray of sunlight almost,
yeah.
Right. Again, this the image, for the most part, the piece are images of night and, to a degree, death and release and relief. But this, a little bit, like the first poem... Vakatin talking about the setting sun is kind of pastoral and peaceful.
And also the setting sun and the melodic lines go down.
Right. So as the sun is setting, the tenor, but especially the horn, the day's grown old, the setting sun, so starts the piece and then the horn comes in. So you can see the image of like the sun in the distance kind of dying away. But the hymn is a up tempo jig, fast and light and sort of a break of from the dark and restful tone of the piece. So it's just kind of a, and also it's kind of traditional, you know, from the Mozart horn concertos, there's always a rondo or a jig, right? A 6/8. And so the jig, well, this hymn is like a jig. Let's see. So again, that's sort of a traditional, it's a little play probably on Mozart or something. It's a little break, a little bit of daylight for you all while you're like contemplating death and and destruction.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Nightfall. And, yes.
The nightfall for England, because returning to England in, you know, in 43 or 42 when he returned, I imagine it was a very difficult time.
Mm.
And so a lot of dark and foreboding. But anyway, so that's a little bit. So don't be alarmed when you hear the horn player come out and playing some notes out of tune. I'm supposed to be doing.
And he also leaves during the last song because he has to go get off stage. And that last song has got the most gorgeous harmonies, including lots of tremendously dissonant notes against the solo voice. And what's fantastic about dissonance, because people say, oh, I hate dissonance, you know. But dissonance is really good when you have resolution. And it's like marriage, you know. you have a little fight and then you make up. And so what happens is that in these particular dissonances, you have this grating collision, tectonic plates, and all of a sudden you land on the beautiful harmony and it feels so good. So this is a great piece.
Yeah, wonderful,
so
wonderful.
I have a great horn to do this with, and also our wonderful tenor. He's got the right voice for this piece, and he really knows it backwards and forwards. So I'm going to leave. You can stay if you
want. No, I'm going to. We're going to go warm up.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you very much. So in our last few minutes, I'd like to say just a few words about the Philip Glass to give you some mental preparation for that piece. Now, I'll admit that I love Philip Glass, or at least I did love Philip Glass when I was a teenager, and I hope this concert draws a different mixture of listeners to hear the orchestra, because we certainly need more support from that generation, and I do see some younger folks out here. Now, what I loved about Glass is that he seemed to mix popular culture with more sophisticated forms of musical expression in creative ways, even if he did repeat himself a lot. Now, when I was in college, for example, I saw Glass and the Kronos Quartet do a live performance of the soundtrack to the old Bela Lugosi Dracula film as the film was playing on a huge screen in the Symphony Hall in downtown Houston. Now, that's the kind of stuff I really went for back then. Now, earlier in the day, Glass had come to the university to talk to some students, and he told us a story about how he used to drive taxis in New York City. One night, a guy got into his cab and said, "You know, you look a lot like this really great composer whose music I just heard at a concert." And then the guy was overjoyed when Glass revealed that it actually was him. It's just that he had a family to support, and composing wasn't exactly the way to do it. He had to have a real job. So to me, then, Glass seemed like a regular guy, and it confirmed all the reasons that I liked him. Now, all this is just a long way of explaining why it's so important to have someone like Philip Glass on the program of a major symphony orchestra. You just don't find his music in this sort of venue very often. He's known for doing other things. And there was a time in his career when he told some interviewers that he just didn't have time to work with orchestras because working with them was difficult. He said there's very little commitment, there's very little money, you get very few performances, and it's all in all a headache to work with an orchestra. Now, 10 years later, though, so this is by the mid-90s, he had obviously changed his tune for once, because he had written 4 symphonies, and he has written a full 10 to date today, so he's up to 10 now. So I guess he beat the curse of 9 of Beethoven and the rest who died after that. Now, I want it written on my gravestone that to write a symphony means something, and tonight I'll explain this piece in a way that makes sense in this context, which is a little bit atypical for Glass. Now, first, Glass has been criticized by the classical music establishment for doing too much crossover work with pop culture, almost like a musical Andy Warhol. His listeners aren't the average orchestra and opera audiences, and the simplicity of his music is often not taken very seriously as a legitimate creative expression. So what might a composer do to turn that reputation around, you might wonder? Well, write a symphony, of course. The symphony is the most revered and well-respected genre of instrumental music, and it has an exclusive cachet among listeners just like you who wouldn't normally approach a piece of music by Glass. So bingo, it's a win-win situation. Glass gets some legitimacy, you get some exposure to new music. Now, some of Glass's symphonies fall more on the side of pop crossover in that they borrow actual materials from pop musicians like David Bowie. But his third symphony is an abstract piece of music with no subtitle, so it doesn't have a programmatic name, and even the movements don't have titles either. It's just movement one, movement two, movement three. So it's about as abstract and Beethovenian as you can get, you might say. Now, in the symphony, we expect the movements to be arranged in a particular way. Fast, slow, dance, fast. Or, in some cases, fast, dance, slow, fast, which is what we have here. Now, this is actually the Beethoven Ninth Symphony model. Not a bad model if I had to choose. So this is one where Beethoven flopped the inner movement so that the third movement is a slow adagio. So as experienced orchestra goers, you will at least be able to connect with the music on that fundamental level. It unfolds like a symphony should unfold. Now, what will be different, though, is how you might experience the music in the moment. The Austrian music theorist Heinrich Schinker believed that all tonal music consists of a dramatic unfolding of the tonic triad, or the key of the piece. The music moves from the original key, in this case C major, to the dominant, or G major. Now, in this new key, it experiences certain manipulations, tensions, pushings, and pullings, and it finally resolves back to the tonic. He called this process the unfolding of the tonic triad. Now, in Glass, what we get instead is a kind of unfolding, but without all the drama. It's more like the slow uncurling of a fern leaf, or the slow ripple of water after a rock lands in the middle of a pond. In the opening of the first movement, for example, we sit on a single chord for a few seconds before we're interrupted by the movement's only melody. There's just one melody throughout the whole movement. Now, this melody is a slow rising line that happens twice in virtually the exact same way, and we'll just listen to this very briefly so you get a sense of what this slowness is like. So this is the first movement, the opening.
And now, Dudley Moore continues to accompany himself on the piano.
Not that again. Here we go. So this is the one chord. Like a very slow sunrise or something. Here's the one melody. And the movement is basically just an exploration of this one melody. As it continues, it keeps returning with a slightly varied texture, a little more rhythmic activity here, a little bit, you know, a few more notes there. So later on, he adds a few different pitches, and then finally some subtle changes in the coloration. So at times, the orchestra will start plucking the strings. Now, all in all, this type of music gives us a new concept of drama, of space, of musical line and progress. We aren't always going somewhere. Maybe we can stop to smell the flowers sometimes. Now, the last excerpt that I'd like to play for you before I let you all out to the hall is the third movement, which is very slow and brooding, with syncopation that's also very characteristic of Glass's writing for string quartet. There's a plodding, steady rhythm in the bass and little melodic material to begin, and in a way it sounds very much like a rock group. It's just very, it's low and kind of pulsing and sweaty, you might say. But then about a third of the way through, there's a beautiful and ethereal violin line that serves as a contrarian voice to this murky swamp. It's like a lone voice crying out in the desert, appropriate for the season of Advent, which is coming up. And it's very plaintive, beautiful, singing, and it really contrasts with the pathos of the accompaniment. So I'd like for you to hear just this beautiful violin line. So here's the brooding accompaniment. See, even though the musical language is very different from a classical symphony that you might be accustomed to, a lot of the larger gestures are very reminiscent of older symphonies. Just to have a slow, soaring violin line and the slow movement is just a very common gesture. So I think you'll be able to connect with it on that level, even if the repetitiveness and the general musical language aren't really your thing. You can at least sense that he's trying to invoke that tradition. And then I would argue that's the way that he's trying to create this legitimate legacy for his future. You know, he doesn't want to be known as just that old pop Warhol-like Philip Glass. He wants to be someone a little bit more substantial than that. Now, George mentioned the fact that Bizet didn't have his piece performed, and I promised that I would relate these things to recording, and George stole my thunder a little bit, which is what this piece wasn't really discovered until the recording era, and I decided that maybe there is a reason why Bizet didn't want to have the work performed, and I think it's because, like what Glass said about writing for orchestras, it's always been true. They might sound great, but it sure is difficult to get 80 people to do what you want them to do. And maybe Bizet understood that in his time and said, well, I'll just work at the opera house. So I'll leave you with that thought, that working with orchestras is difficult, but somehow they managed to create beautiful music anyway. And so you'll hear three wonderful pieces tonight, and I hope you enjoyed hearing excerpts from the first two works. So thank you very much for coming.